All right, I call to order the Conference Committee on House File 1542. A quorum is present. Thank you, everyone, for your patience as we work through the final amendment. If we could have Senate Counsel Ms. Pontius walk through the Amendment A-13.
Mr. Chairman, members, the first section is something that's new, and this is just really a conforming amendment. Right now, the statute of limitations under the Human Rights Act is suspended during the period of time a person has to give the notice. And because of some changes that occur later in the bill, it's better just to refer to the time period during which they can't bring an action as opposed to what the notice, because it could either be like 60 or 90 days. So that's just a conforming amendment. You can see on lines 1.21 to 1.23. And then section 2 is the operative notice language. Oh, yeah. And that does have an immediate effective date, too, which the whole bill does. And then if you look at section 2, the first part is fairly close to what are in both the House and Senate bills right now. The main difference, if you look on 1.29 and 1.30, it refers to a person who is an attorney or is represented by an attorney. The current language in both the House and Senate bills would not apply to the attorney pro se's, because they're not considered to be represented by an attorney. So this would pick up those individuals as well in terms of who has to give the notice. And there is a change from both bills, actually, in this draft on the whole pro se issue. So some of these changes kind of flow with that. It takes out the separate notice, kind of abbreviated notice that the current bill is required to be given by pro se parties, so that is no longer in this language. And then if you move to page 2, this is, if you look at the first part there, there's a rewrite on starting the time for a response. Oh, I think that's in both bills right now, which is a double check here. The time for response on page 294 is the same as what's in both bills right now. And there's some other changes made kind of consistent with the dropping the notice requirement for pro se parties. There's new language on page 2, line 14, and this is a difference that exists in the House and Senate bills, that the House bill currently has language that allows a delay in the time when a violation or barrier has to be removed. And this is similar to what's in the House bill on page 2, starting page 2, line 16. But it does require that the business establishment or place of public accommodation has to indicate in writing an intent to remove the barrier, but then has to demonstrate that weather prevents a timely renewal. And it gives them another 60 days after the response time and the notice. 30 days after response time in the notice. I think you get the House bill certainly currently says 90 days after the date of the initial notice. So it may or may, depending on what that date is, it may or may not result in more time or less time. And there's just some technical reworking of the effective date language there. And then Section 3 is new, and this is an attempt to get at the issue where somebody is not represented by an attorney, they're not an attorney, so they're not required to give the notice, but then they retain an attorney within 60 days after an action is brought. So in those cases, that attorney would have to provide a notice that includes at least an identification of the barriers that are the subject of the violation, and the law that's violated. And then they'd also have to include part of the form. So again, it's a somewhat abbreviated notice requirement that would apply in cases where someone retained an attorney after bringing an action. And then there's additional language that just tries to address procedural issues in those cases, because there would have been a civil action perhaps filed, perhaps not. If it hasn't been filed, it can't be filed until expiration of the time period for a response that's given in the notice. And then if it has been filed, there would be a stay of the proceedings going forward until the notice period expired. And then Section 4 is kind of a meld of the House and Senate language. One of the differences between the two bills, if you look at page 3, line 13, the House bill just strikes, refers to a physical, so it's damages resulting from a physical injury. And in the Senate, current Senate bill, it strikes the entire clause. So this is the Senate position on that issue, just strikes that clause completely. And then there's just kind of a rewrite of some of the clarifying language, which is consistent with current law, in that no one would be prevented from filing a charge with the commissioner, or in cases where they have filed a charge, to bring a civil action consistent with the current law. And Mr. Chairman, I think I hit all the main points there. Okay. I hope that makes sense.
Oh, that was great. Thank you, Ms. Pontius. And if I could ask conferees to withhold any questions or comments. We have two insignificant verbal amendments that we're going to take up in a moment. I'd like to move to public testimony, though. And first, Ms. Pedman, please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Okay. My name is – can you hear me if I just sit like this? Okay. My name is Kim Pettman, and I live in the Sauk Rapids, St. Cloud area. And then I think I have approximately 5 minutes. Is that okay?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay. So I became disabled approximately 2006. I come from a family where one family member has used a wheelchair since age 9, and I thought I understood until I became disabled. And I think in some ways that might be part of this whole discussion. When it affects you directly or your family member, then it's a lot easier to understand. I've lived in the St. Cloud area for approximately 4 years, and it's been very hard to deal with accessibility, also sometimes in the metro area. I think a really good solution would be better communication with the business community and with people with disabilities. So what I'd like to do is quickly talk about some of my ideas, some of the concerns I have with this bill, and I'll try to keep it under 5 minutes. So just to get this out of the way, because I know some people have questions, I have a fat disorder. It's called lipoedema. It's a medical condition. I have lymphedema, which is lymphatic fluid that swells, and I have a collagen deficiency called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome type 3, which means joints can pop out. So what I need to do, and when I go places, I need to call ahead and ask if that place is accessible to me. A lot of people don't know this. When you use paratransit, Metro Mobility, or Dial-A-Ride, or other services, they leave you for at least an hour. So many people with disabilities can't just show up, take a tour. They need to call ahead. So a problem that is kind of in this bill is that in my local area and also in the metro, I will call or I will email and I will just ask a question. Can I talk to the manager? I have some accessibility questions. They ignore me many times. They won't answer an email. They won't return my call. And I know this happens to other people. So that's a communication problem. After working with people or trying to get them to hear me for about a year or 2 years or 3 years, I get frustrated and so do other people. So a solution could be more education for business owners and local governments. Please, when somebody's asking you a question about accessibility, can you at least answer their questions? That would save a whole lot of problems. And also to please take very basic ADA education classes. There's many resources that are free and available. A two-hour class would solve a lot of problems. Minnesota State Council on Disabilities offers free training. Great Lakes ADA Center offers free training available on the web. But basically, when I and others have tried so many times to talk about why accessibility is good, we've called, we've emailed, and we keep getting ignored. At some point, when you get trapped in your own home and your community, you don't know what to do. So the other thing is I'm very concerned about the 60-day notice. Again, it has to do with communication. The best thing that people could do is at least respond to inquiries, and then it doesn't have to escalate to the level of a civil action. One thing to know is that there's a very severe direct worker shortage. So many people with disabilities, they might not even have enough help in their home to do things called basic activities of daily living, which means get up and get ready for work or school. And so to put this burden on them, you know, this extra burden, when they don't have help, even for their own activities, it's really hard. And then the other thing is ADA has been around since 1990, since summer of 92, for buildings. And I can definitely tell you that a lot of businesses, not all businesses, but a lot of businesses are not taking the time to proactively learn about the basics of ADA when those classes and trainings are offered to them. And if they would just take a little bit of time and do that, it would save so many problems. The other thing that I would like to recommend, and this is not making fun of anyone, if you're doing this in the right way, it's for a good reason. If people that have a business could get in a wheelchair or mobility device and try to navigate their building, Pasco, Washington City Council did this, and they checked out their city, and they found it very informative. So educational opportunities or just looking at things from another person's perspective can really help. So I guess in conclusion, it's communication, it's learning, and it's taking the time. 2 hours of training can save a lot of problems. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony and being here today. At this point, we'd like to ask the Department of Human Rights to come down and make a statement. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Chair Smith and members of the committee. Thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Scott Butel. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. We appreciate all the work that we have been able to do with the bill authors and other stakeholders on this issue and feel that the A13 amendment before the committee at this point is a good compromise that is workable for all of the stakeholders, for the communities, for individuals with disabilities. As currently drafted, as is stated in the letter that is on the table and I believe in your packets, the Department of Human Rights will recommend that the governor sign this bill. To give a little, just very brief, big picture perspective, as a department that deals with civil rights issues, disability discrimination claims are actually our most common claims. They're not most often these type of architectural barrier claims, but in sort of considering the needs of the community, we recognize that this is a growing area. This is an area that, as a state, we need to proactively address all throughout the state, not just in the metro area, not just in rural Minnesota. We have an aging population. We have more individuals with acquired disabilities throughout their lives, and we want to make sure that kind of as a state, we are living up to the promise of fully accessible communities, whether that's in terms of physical infrastructure, in terms of employment, in terms of services. And that fits in with the broader landscape of the state's Olmstead Plan, working to confront some of these issues and other areas. And so we feel privileged to have worked with all the folks we've had the opportunity to work with on this issue. we hope to continue to work with everybody who's both been at the table from the legislative side and from the community stakeholder side in terms of trying to ensure that there are more proactive steps being taken, since I think we recognize with accessibility the best scenario is for more places to be proactively in compliance to help ensure that individuals are able to fully engage with the community and aren't confronting undue barriers. And so that to us is an ideal end goal. I know there have been some conversations already about how do we use things like the building code and building inspectors to help ensure that there are more proactive efforts being made in that realm. I know there's been legislation already introduced on that, and we look forward to continuing to engage on that and work on that. We always seek to be a resource for the legislature and the community, and we hope that we can continue to build this partnership. So thank you.
Great. On behalf of myself and Senator Ralph and the other conferees, we appreciate your efforts on this bill as well as Commissioner Lindsay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify?
Yes.
Well, please come forward. Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is David Katroser. I've spoken to some members of the House and the Senate already, but I'm still troubled by this bill to a great extent. The MHRA was enacted in 1983. In the 34 years since its passage, there was no significant architectural barrier litigation to enforce the law until Mr. Hansmeier began his abuses about 2.5 years ago. That absence of litigation was accompanied by a widespread disinterest in eliminating architectural barriers, resulting in a current environment that includes violations everywhere, from no legal handicap parking in the Minneapolis Convention Center parking ramp to no bathroom stalls in the University of Minnesota Biomedical Library that allow a person in a wheelchair to enter the stall and close the door. 1 month ago, I took a class to become a certified accessibility specialist. That class was given by the state of Minnesota at the Department of Labor and Industry building. Though the instructors were teaching us the requirements of the accessibility building code, the building we were in had an inaccessible bathroom and inaccessible handicap parking. The testimony in the committee hearings for this bill almost exclusively described its purpose as eliminating abusive litigation. But the insertion of the change in the bill to include attorneys who are not representing plaintiffs shows the real purpose, which is to eliminate all architectural barrier litigation. There is no part of this bill that I can find that specifically targets litigation abuse cases any more than reasonable architectural barrier cases. This is literally throwing out the baby with the bathwater. A pro se attorney plaintiff is incapable of generating abusive litigation because the U.S. Supreme Court has already decided that pro se plaintiffs can't get attorney's fees. Without the threat of getting attorney's fees for the plaintiff, litigation becomes equally onerous for plaintiff and defendant, and no large settlements result. I am the only plaintiff pro se attorney in the state of Minnesota doing architectural barrier cases. That particular clause in the new bill might as well have my name on it. Most of my cases settle for $1,000 or less. That pays for costs and very little else, and is far less than any attorney-represented plaintiff would ever accept to settle a case. Adding the pro se component to this bill does nothing to prevent lawsuit abuse or eliminate architectural barriers. Instead, it's an impediment to all plaintiff litigation. and it will discourage any enforcement of the MHRA architectural barrier regulations and continue the pattern of accessibility neglect that has existed for most of the last 34 years. Nobody has done this for 34 years besides the abusive attorneys and me. Why would anyone think that anyone's going to do it in the foreseeable future? Nothing is going to happen. People with disabilities have always been able to complain about obstacles, but they don't, because there are so many obstacles, as you've just heard, in the community, that would be all they would do. They rarely know which obstacles are forbidden and should be cited and which are allowed. Instead, they constrict their lives by avoiding inaccessible locations. This is a civil rights law. Please don't punish the victims of discrimination. There is no one out there who is going to enforce this law other than attorneys who think they can make a reasonable amount of profit on it. And if you are an attorney or know an attorney, when an attorney takes a case where they're only going to get paid if they win, they get paid more. Those are called contingency fee cases. This is a case in which the attorney only gets paid if they win, and yet we're asking the attorney to only get their hourly rate. Attorneys don't take those cases. That's why no one's doing them. The only people that are doing them are the abusive cases. But now you're adding one other piece. You're trying to stop me from doing them, even though nobody's suggesting that I'm making exorbitant claims, only that I'm trying to get things corrected. Why, I have to ask, is that section in there? If the goal is to eliminate architectural barriers, I'll take any questions. Otherwise, that's all I have.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have a question. Senator Frentz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, fellow conferees, and thanks, Dr. Katroza, for coming. My question goes right to the word abuse. Tell me what it is about the notice requirement that will prevent a plaintiff or their attorney or a pro se litigant from pursuing a barrier case. What does that notice requirement prevent that attorney and that claimant from doing, in your view?
Dr. Katroza.
If the notice requirement is part of the bill, then no business establishment has any incentive whatsoever to ever correct anything until they're given notice. They haven't done it in the last 34 years. There's no reason to expect that they will do it in the future until someone gives them notice. Then when they're given notice, they have 60 days to correct it. If they correct it within those 60 days, you may recall that the bill already includes an affirmative defense. That affirmative defense has been argued by many defense attorneys to be an affirmative defense to all subsequent litigation on that matter. I've heard some suggestion that it maybe would allow you to just eliminate the injunction part, and there would still be the ability to make litigation for your damages. But the courts are not going to see the emotional damage litigation being worth very much, and I can see the courts allowing de minimis damages for that. We'd be talking about going forward in litigation that would never pay for itself. It would be basically charity work for whoever would do it. So what you're saying is you'd like someone to go out there and give 60-day notices to places so that they would know that they have to fix it for free, for charity. That's not what this law is supposed to be about. It's not, if these businesses want to know what their violations are, they have the ability to go out and hire an accessibility specialist to evaluate their facility and let them know what the problems are. They choose not to do that. They're waiting until someone comes and gives them notice. How is it that the person who's being abused is under the obligation to tell the abuser what they're doing wrong? If the idea here is we're all supposed to be nice, moral, ethical people, doesn't the abuser have the obligation of figuring out what they're doing that's wrong rather than the abused telling them?
Senator Franks.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, and thank you again, conferees. Dr. Katrosier, I just would like to call attention to the fact that you've used the term abusive lawsuits with the assumption that the lawsuits themselves are abusive, and in the same testimony you've used the word de minimis. And I think what we're trying to do here is address the opportunity of a business to respond to a de minimis barrier in a way that serves the public interest, provides access for the community of people with disabilities, and should there be reasonable damages, attorney's fees, whatever is to be the case, that the person with the disability will still be able to pursue them. And I believe what the A13 Amendment protects and preserves is the right of people with disabilities to do that if they feel it's there. If it is a de minimis barrier violation, I believe the intent of the bill and the amendment is to say we may want the business to have an opportunity to correct that, which I would humbly disagree is free. It's at the business's expense. And as Senator Ralph and I have talked about many times, if the business chooses not to repair the defect, that's their prerogative also, and litigation will pursue. Thank you very much, Doctor, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Petrosa, comment?
Yes, there's nothing in the bill that I can see that treats de minimis violations differently than significant ones. The damages that happen afterwards happen because you can't get in. If I go to a facility and their bathroom is configured so that I can't shut the door to the stall, that would be de minimis. If I can't get in the building because they don't have any handicap parking, that would be de minimis by your definition, because the only thing that I suffered was I couldn't get in. What are my damages? What's the court going to decide the damages are for that? They're going to be fairly small. They're not going to be $1,000. They're not going to be $100. And that is not going to justify lawsuits.
Senator Franks.
Thank you one last time, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Katrosier. The question of whether it's de minimis or not is in the eye of the plaintiff and the defendant. And what we're seeking to do is have that be a question for both plaintiff and defendant, whether they choose to call it de minimis or not, or whether a judge or jury chooses to award de minimis damages for returning the playing field to a level area, where if the bathroom door violation is de minimis to the plaintiff, they can tell the judge that. If it's significant to the plaintiff, and I have no doubt it is in many cases, they can tell that to the judge too. And the eventual sorting out of those claims will be done at the district court level, where just like every other type of plaintiff's litigation, automobile accidents, medical malpractice, businesses suing other businesses, the ultimate arbiter is the judge and the jury system. And each plaintiff and each defendant gets to decide how they want to proceed. And these are the rules that the state is proposing to put forward, and I support them. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments for Dr. Petrosa? Thank you very much for being here today. Appreciate that.
May I ask one question?
Oh, you may make a statement. Dr. Petrosa.
Is it explicitly part of the law that the affirmative defense does not dismiss the damages part of the injury, the emotional injury, etc.? Because a number of attorneys have argued that the affirmative defense portion of the law as it stands eliminates the ability to go forward with any lawsuit, even if they fixed it. So does just fixing it eliminate the ability to do a lawsuit?
All right. Thank you very much for your statement. Appreciate you being here this morning. Any other testimony from the public? Okay. Seeing no other testimony from the public, we'll move to the verbal amendments. There are two of them. Senator Ralph, the first one is on line 2.25 on the A13.
Yes, we would, on line 2.25, after the word person, would add the language not represented by an attorney. And then on line 2.26, you want to, okay, so I would move that amendment.
All right, that amendment is moved. Any questions or comments? Seeing no questions or comments, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries. On to your next amendment, verbal, Senator Ralph, line 2.26.
That's correct. After the word is, which follows the words civil action, we would add under section 363A.33.
Repeat it, please.
I'm sorry. On line 2.26, after the word is, insert under section 363A.33.
Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor of this motion signify by saying aye.
Uh-huh.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries. There's one more amendment, verbal. And the next verbal amendment is on line 2.33, Senator Ralph.
At the end of the line, after the word rule, the number 2.7 needs to be changed to the number 12 to correctly identify the rules of procedure.
Any discussion or questions about that motion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries. That concludes the verbal amendments. On to the adoption of the deleted amendments in the Senate 1542 A13 as amended. Senator Frentz, would you care to make said motion?
I would be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A13 amendment.
Thank you. Is there any questions or discussion? Yes. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to clarify, not being a lawyer, this sometimes gets a little confusing for me. So I just want to make sure that I've got the understandings of it is, in the area where we've got a pro se person who is doing a filing, this would not prevent them from at some point in time going to an attorney and hiring an attorney themselves, correct?
Yes, Representative Fisher, that is correct. There's no prohibition in that regard at all.
Okay. And then the other part, and this is where I got a little bit confused on, is if somebody who was pro se did hire an attorney, there's a time frame in there, is because if you have an attorney and there's the notice you have to give. How does that notice period work if you were pro se, then hired the attorney?
Senator Ruff.
Representative Fisher, there's a short period of time. Basically, the idea here is that we don't want someone using a pro se litigant to avoid the notice requirement where there is an intent to hire an attorney or to bring the action by an attorney. So for a period of 60 days after a pro se litigant starts an action, which means they serve a summons and complaint, or they file it, they've served it, and then they file the complaint. Within that 60-day period, if they then retain an attorney, then that then this section, subdivision 2A, would become effective, and they would have to follow the various things that are set forth. It would extend the period of time for answer or amended answer. It would provide a suspense of the rules of civil procedure. It stays the periods there for that 60-day period, but in no way does it interfere with the person's right to bring an action and then subsequently hire an attorney. After 60 days, everything goes back to normal. Basically, everything is followed the standard rules, the standard time frames. So this is to allow us to have pro se litigants, if someone seriously wants to do that, without having to use the notice provisions in the bill.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's kind of where I was wondering is on the timing is what if they do file, say if they filed at the 45-day mark and got an attorney at that point in time, would the attorney then have to give the notice in for the entire 60-day period, or is it a fraction thereof?
It would be,
Senator Rouse.
It would be the entire 60-day period.
Okay. Representative Fisher?
Okay. Well, thank you. That helps.
Any other questions or comments about this motion? Seeing none, Senator France renews his motion to adopt the Delete All Amendment, Senate Council 1542A13 as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed nay. Motion carries. On to the adoption of the bill as amended. Representative Fisher, would you care to make said motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would.
Representative Fisher moves to adopt this bill as amended. Any questions or discussion? Seeing no questions or discussion, Representative Fisher renews his motion to adopt this bill as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed nay. Motion carries. And with that, Senator Rolfe and I would like to thank all the staff, partisan and nonpartisan, in both chambers, as well as all the conferees and everyone's patience this morning. Thank you very much. With that, this committee stands adjourned.